And once, soon after this vision, in crossing the East River to New York on the Brooklyn ferry boat, I saw a painful contrast, for the we wandered, and floated, and steamed about for 3/4 of an hour, in a fog that had a remarkably bad smell. And I had just arisen from the studio in which that entire spiritual truth had been developed, with the recollection of the emanations from the amber-like river to the north of Starnose. What a contrast between the two worlds! Hovering over the bosom of the heavenly river was a fragrance from countless flowers. A gentleman who is an expert in science says that he can demonstrate that the photographic instrument can photograph invisible substances. Thus mankind are getting ready to take the spirit form, to establish the beautiful fact, by photographic developments. Art has made the nearest approach to painting unsubstantial shadows, so that the human eye can, with admiring satisfaction, look upon them. Perhaps, in this manner, one of these days, art will catch the fragrance of a flower, so that you can take the likeness of an odor to your friends. Men will then say, is it possible that for centuries and centuries immemorial we have been only able to smell without seeing, while now we can see what we have known only by the olfactory nerves? Now, I will again say that the odoriferous emanations from that beautiful amber river were visible, and that they constituted, above the stream, what Fourier, in speaking of the ultimate of this planet, called a boreal crown. It anomaly rose up and swept over for thousands of miles both east and west. What a magnificent rainbow was that, with colors to which no human eye is accustomed. Here there were, in colors, new developments, rich, splendid. And do you suppose that a brother of the Akkadian go upon that scene and not worship the infinite mind? Every human mind would in one moment be moved to feelings of purest devotion and highest adoration. Our rainbow here is a philosophical fact, unless the system of nature be a fraud, and the spiritual counterpart is a continuation of this on a grander principle. The fact exists in science, and you cannot dodge the conclusion, that, in other spheres, similar phenomena may occur. My aunt owes to is an Italian brotherhood, in a very different section of the summerland. This brotherhood is distinguished by some of the most beautiful women that ever lived on the face of the earth. It in one of the most celestial and attractive. And behold what hospitalities the my aunt Ovestians receive when they visit the Zelabingians. They journey to the latter brotherhood from time to time, and there the sweet singers of the my aunt Oves to join the anthems of the groups, and their voices rise up and blend like drops of dew in the air. I wonder not, having heard the music of this great association, that many Christians conceive the kingdom of heaven to be a perpetual singing school, a protracted Methodist meeting, continuing years and centuries, while they adore God, with hymns of praise, gratitude, and thanksgiving, in this manner occupying their time throughout the infinite periods. And this is the Orthodox Christian's conception of heaven. Human nature must be entirely changed at death to make it possible to realize such a conception. Nay. It is a philosophic, scientific, phrenological, affectional, logical, spiritual, religious absurdity. Yet, remembering the effect produced when the Zelabingian society joins its wondrous, magnificent melody with the my aunt Ovester, then, I sometimes think that, from this celestial fact, the early Christians may have obtained their conception that the eternity in the kingdom of heaven is devoted to the cheerful works of music and praying. Pialolsky is another Russian association. It is peculiar, and distinguished for its musical properties. Having heard the songs of these musical gatherings, I feel the impulse to urge our brothers and sisters to open their mouths and bring forth the joyful hymns of progress and praise. No wonder that I would have song poured from everybody's mouth. It has almost lifted me up to the thought of having nothing cultivated in this world save music. When I first heard the anvil chorus, it seemed after all as though the multifarious sounds of noisy cities would one of these days be set to music. I had no appreciation of such a combination of sounds and parts as constituted an opera until these celestial sounds came through the clairaudience of my own spirit, thus educating the mind to breathe in the significance of music, as well as to comprehend somewhat of its physical vesture. Senlosius and Helvetius are celebrated even in the Summerland for their logical peculiarities and intellectual endowments. Baron Holbach, too, and those who believe in his doctrines, seem to think the time will come when men's minds will wholly outgrow any idea of God, that there is no necessity and no philosophy for such an impossible being. They believe and teach many about them that God is a supernatural absurdity, that there is no supernaturalism. They sometimes think the absurdity itself is absurd, and they advocate among themselves, and fearlessly in the presence of those about them, the same fundamental thoughts that rule the affections of the earthly society which they formed before they left the earth. Professor Webster, of the Dr. Parkman history, went among such minds, not by invitation, but in association with others who were going to see and to listen. And when he first appeared to a circle in Springfield, Mass, he reported a peculiar doctrine which the medium was afraid to write or have reported. It was really the doctrine of the Helvetian school, much modified, but essentially the same. Swedenborg truly says that, in the spirit world, the different associations, nationalities, tribes, and religious sects continue. The philosophers of the atheistical school, especially Senlosius, make these notions a matter of society, so that the children of parents who think as they do, and the wives of those men who so think, and persons in other brotherhoods, have large sentimental gatherings, where they enjoy festivities and conversation. Human nature here is human nature there. We have here a New England society, the Western Association, or the Knickerbocker Association, etc., and the different clubs. It is the same thing there, only on a grander and more harmonious scale. Archilarium is the name of an open pavilion where these teachers gather the multitudes who want to listen. When this assemblage was witnessed by me in 1858, it seemed like a vast convention, not, however, characterized by the turbulency of earthly gatherings. They all seemed to take a great deal of interest in everything said and done. It was a celestial convention, held out in the open fields of heaven, beautiful, fair, mossy, and bedecked with every variety of flowering plants. Vivodario is the name of that oratorio, of that beautiful section of river, to which I referred in the early part of this discourse. And the beautiful Octolonia, is the angel writer and poetess, a gifted lady in the Summerland, who developed and arranged the sublimest piece of music in the whole brotherhood of Zellerbingen. It was written long after death by this beautiful German lady spirit. Octolonia, is the name given to her in consequence of her great attainments and accomplishments. Her name is her coronation, it shines from her brow, it sparkles and shimmers through her beautiful locks. She seems to be radiant with the music of which she was the authoress. Alcemira, is the name of a traveler who had arrived just at the time when this clairvoyant observation was made. Alcemira, too, is a most beautiful woman, who, in this world, had desires for journeying which had never had any gratification. But when she felt her feet free upon the green fields of paradise, she openly declared and made an oath that she would have her soul gratified with excursions. And verily, this beautiful woman, Alcemira, has travelled 20 times farther than from here to the Sunday she had just arrived from one excursion, and, with the poetess, stood where the mimic was just about beginning, and that was the glorious scene, and the time, when I heard the grandest mimic possible to imagine. The social scenes in the Summerland, which I was enabled to am 2 days after what is above mentioned and which included the enchanting festivities, were beyond all verbal description. I will not detain you by a single word upon them, they may come up, perhaps as a future reference. Las Amas Artu is the name of a convent, or what would here be called a monastery. There are persons who still verily believe that the Roman Catholic faith is God's exclusive religion. Such spirits hover over their congenial earthly congregations. Therefore the Roman Catholics do experience real inspirations, not revelations. Remember, because revelations open and enlighten the judgment, whilst inspirations excite, vivify, and warm our spirits to action. Many persons are truly inspired who have not common sense. In fact, they may be very highly inspired, and still be very unwise in their externals. On the other hand, when a man has a real revelation, which gently expands and opens the faculties of thought, and which also brings proportion, and depth, and solidity, then inspiration becomes to that man's faculties what sun heat is to the flowers, and grains, and grasses. It is a cause of growth and of steady fertilization. Now these Catholics of our earth really feel the hovering endorsement and benedictions of the La Samizdat, the tenants of a vast convent. It is a place shut in by mountains that fill the distance away off, like Alps upon Alps, only not with those abrupt and pointed summits, but like innumerable oceans they seem to roll down to the garden of the convent. If the earthly astronomer could but gaze upon this scene with his telescope, it would seem to him as though he was contemplating new star fields in the heavens, his beauty and magnitude far beyond his ability to transmit in language, or to map down for the longing eyes of his waiting fellow men. The La Samizdat, instead of being it place where a few thousand can gather, make on. Laying all the Roman Catholics who have gone into the spirit world for many past centuries, and hence it is vastly larger than the states of both Illinois and Wisconsin. You ask, do they all live there? I answer by asking, do you suppose that there is coercion? Is the internal government of the spirit land more arbitrary, more despotic than this? Will you not there be more, instead of less, generous and kind to all forms of faith? Will the good father and mother send policemen or missionaries armed with rods and whips to drive men who do not believe the exact letter? No, no. Human nature continues the same. Therefore Roman Catholic associations in the next sphere are just as inevitable and natural as anywhere on the face of the earth. I will speak of other things. A great white flower was seen in the same month. It is called the Archibalum, a beautiful word, meaning the white temple of the children. And there, near the garden containing these flowers, are persons we read of in the Bible. There, I observed those who would not be comforted, Rachel, and also very many beautiful Jewesses, and the Israelitish women who were called heroines in the old Hebrew scriptures. The Archibalum is a vast white flower, so constituted as to represent the image of beautiful children grouped directly at its center. It seems to grow full 100 feet from the earth. Many admiring spirits seem to think they see in the flower's center a beautiful representation of the son of Mary and Joseph, when he said, "Suffer little children to come unto me." It is the divinest flower of all that section of the summer land. And the early Hebrew women look with great delight upon the Archibalum, with the picture of an assembly of children at its center, one of the most marvelous floral developments in the garden of God. Do not forget, friends, that I am speaking to you of scenes in the Summerland, the next door neighbor to all this circle of planets, of which the Earth is a member. What would you say if you should hear somewhat concerning the third sphere, of the one beyond that, or of another and still higher? I have seen mediums who think they receive communications from the innumerable upper places. No. Many of them have not heard from the gifted in these brotherhoods. Now and then some one of them says, "Oh, that is nothing. The next spirit world is nothing. I get communications from the seventh heaven, away up out of sight." That is all ecstatic inspiration, without any analyzing judgment, no revelation to balance the mind in truth. Men and women get more humility when they get more wisdom. Pomposity of intellect is the best proof of its shallowness. When a truly sublime idea comes to you, then, expressive silence is alone natural and worthy. Words are an impertinence. Aurelia is the general name for a class of pulsating lilies. These golden and graceful plants grow by the peaceful homes of those pure souls who wish them. Aurelia represents is new hopes, or freshened hopes. It grows by the heavenly homes of many good, high-born souls in the spirit world. Some persons who have lived in New York, and some who have departed from among our households, have been seen where these beautiful pulsating indications of fresh and hopes vibrate in the soft, beautiful zephyrs of the immortal sphere. Oabula is the name of a brotherhood of Sandwich Islanders, which I saw almost by an accident, when I was looking for something very different. The circumstance may interest you. I took up a newspaper and saw the name of Aaron Burr. I had never read anything concerning him. I had heard that he was a peculiar man, a politician, etc. I had also heard some conversation about him. I said, I wonder if I cannot get some information with reference to him. This was early in the first year of the Herald of Progress, about 3 years ago. The question occupied my thoughts for three different mornings, and, on the third session, clairvoyance was complete, and the vision opened, but I did not see Aaron Burr as I expected to, but I saw a much smaller man, with a brow that was not yet clear of a singular shadow, which immediately drew my attention, and I said, I wish I could know what it is that so shades that man's brow. I saw nothing above him that could cast a shadow, nor had he anything upon his head. He was surrounded and conversing with a great many others. They were seemingly interested in something pertaining to the war then approaching on Earth, and with reference to some persons who were their earthly relatives, whom they knew would soon be among them from the battlefields. But above all, this man's shaded brow drew my clairvoyant attention. I wished to know who he was, and to learn what the shadow meant. At length I saw that he was Alexander Hamilton. In his company I saw none of the early American statesmen, but there were many intelligent persons with him, and of different races. Soon Mr. Hamilton unveiled his memory and began to think, and I could see the thoughts roll out at the front part of his mind, and each was as clear to my inward vision as is any object to the physical eye. I saw in his memory a place that I had seen on Earth. At first I could not recognize it sufficiently to locate it. But presently it grew more familiar. I had seen the trees, and the walks, and the grass, and the mountain, and the Hudson River. I looked again, and thought for a while, and then I remembered that it was Hoboken. In a few minutes some 8 men appeared, and be among the rest. And now I saw in his thought a regret that he had been weak enough, low enough in the moral scale, so actuated by pride and a false code of honor, as ever to have permitted Aaron Burr to send him, before his time, into the Summerland. And I could see distinctly the figures 1804, the year in which Burr shot him, 24 hours afterward be passed, a duelist, to the afterlife. For days he was in a deep, dreamy slumber. When he awoke, he found upon his brow this shadow. The cause of his regret dates back half a century, still there is a shadow just over his brow and upon his head. The lemon is impressive and easily learned. It is be for all to be right and to do right. No man or woman is wholly innocent, no one perfect. If you are not good and strong enough to save and prevent another from doing you a wrong, the weakness goes with you, and its effects will shade you somewhere, either in person or in spirit, and you cannot conceal a weakness so perfectly as you can in this world. The Oahula is the association of Sandwich Islanders where Alexander Hamilton was temporarily sojourning, which I saw by an accident, so to say, when trying to find Aaron Burr. Oahula was constituted of persons who had passed on from those earth islands into the spirit world. Wallavastu and Passita both are realms of various peaceful and affiliated tribes of Indians. The hatchet is really buried, and the pipe of peace is smoked. At last the red man has found his hunting grounds. The sachems and the wigwams, the great forests and the regions of beauty to traverse, and the shining lakes for bathing and fishing, these ideal dreams of the old Indians are more than actualized in the Summerland. The immortal Indian, whose untutored mind sees God in clouds and hears him in the wind, is just as good a Christian as they who sat at the feet of Jesus, because the Eternal breathed infallible instinctive truths into his unfettered mind. In the depths of intuition he obtained four glimpses of the beautiful immortal realm, not like these barren wastes and rude territories granted by government, but a land given by the Great Spirit to the Red Man, who is as much a child of God as is any member of the Zelabingian, as much as the highest archangel who dwells in yet higher spheres in the spiritual universe. Next headline, Social Centers in the Summerland. If I have told you earthly things, and ye believe not, how shall ye believe if I tell you of heavenly things? It appears to me that the foregoing words are peculiarly applicable to the subject matter of this discourse. The third chapter of John opens one of the richest minds of Platonic philosophy. You remember that the doctrine of the new birth, or what is theologically called regeneration, is there introduced in behalf of persons who were imperfectly generated and badly born to start with minds only half or two-thirds made up, sent into this breathing world full of physiological mistakes and psychological errors, which must be either voluntarily outgrown, or else involuntarily agonized through to a successful issue. Regeneration being theologically prescribed as the true medicine, the only divine plan, projecting over immense sins, shortening the road to Abraham's bosom, economizing or transcending the methods of justice, and saving the sinner from the pit of eternal and well-merited punishments. But I believe that all who voluntarily leave the world, the flesh, alcohol, tobacco, and the other devils, practically set their spirits and their bodies sailing toward the immortal future. Such pay the genuine coin at the ticket office of repentance, they comply with the conditions, and are guaranteed a safe and happy voyage to the heavenly kingdom. But look at the church plan. From the many probations that are granted and accepted, and judging from the many false steps and moral mistakes made by the converts, it is probable that multitudes run off the track. Notwithstanding the fact that they voluntarily enlisted in the spiritual army, purchased tickets in the pew department, and started with all the best sympathies of the brothers and sisters in Jesus, with the combined prayers of a mighty congregation to keep their souls steady toward the goal, still great numbers switch off and run for years in the world's popular cracks. Nicodemus could not properly understand the mysterious simplicity of a spiritual birth. I never saw a Nicodemus that could. A materialist, a man who believes only in the obvious, in weights and measures, who acquires his knowledge through the external, is a man whose thoughts extend only to the question which was put by Nicodemus. One of the most beautiful sons of the Infinite Father replied to him in astonishment, "Art thou a master in Israel, that is, art thou a learned lawyer, a doctor of divinity, a responsible public man, a governor over many people, and knowest not these things?" Think of a leader of the people, standing up in authority before multitudes, influencing their feelings and conduct, and yet knowing not that that which is flesh, and that which is spirit. To be born of water, as well as of the spirit, is too much like the hydropathic system of Kew to be congenial to most persons. It is supposed to be more pleasant and less laborious to be born of the spirit of sentiment, of good endeavor, and of the conscious possession of high motives. But it is quite too practical to be also born of a clean body, which means water. I am rejoiced and grateful that some such man as John the Baptist, the forerunner, perceived the beautiful emblematic induction, and made the demonstration that the physical temple is the basis on which the intellectual and spiritual superstructure must be erected, that a true new birth begins in the body department. If I have told you earthly things, and ye believe not, how shall ye believe if I tell you of heavenly things? That is to say, if a person, when testifying of common earthly things, is known to be as truthful and unimpeachable as others who believe a very different creed, known to be as reliable in his speech and in character as his orthodox neighbors, why can you not as readily believe the same person when he soberly speaks of elevated things, which exist out of and beyond the sensuous sphere? The question is very simple. Nicodemus, not being acquainted with the science of electricity and meteorology, could not understand what caused the wind to rush from one place and blow into another. Inasmuch as he could not comprehend the law of the blowing tempests, nor the wafting of the gentle evening zephyrs, how could he understand the simple mystery of the birth of the Spirit? The progressive growth of the Spirit in truth and right is more mysterious than the coming and going of terrestrial winds. Inasmuch, therefore, as most men are yet ignorant of the common phenomena of the physical world, is it not presumptuous in them to stand up in the midst of this temple of God and proclaim their superficial skepticisms concerning profounder, deeper, vaster, more elevated things? Hundreds pompously denounce spiritual things while they know little or nothing of the underlying laws and refined conditions by which these marvelous visions and rich experiences are obtained. Such minds arrogantly presume to sit in final judgment upon the spiritual experience of others. The Nazarene, when answering Nicodemus, was compelled to raise the question of personal veracity. If, he said substantially, I am worthy of being believed when telling you of ordinary things, if I am entitled to be trusted in earthly things, why should not my testimony be accepted when I speak of things elevated, supersensuous, celestial, and heavenly? Every mind intuitively recognizes the eternal value of pure purposes. The converse of the proposition is as self-evident, that is, the eternal disadvantage of immoral purposes, nesting and breeding in the centers of individual life. We should urge this statement of the question, were it not true that the divine constitution of the material and spiritual universe so works, that out of darkness light is born, out of evil, good, out of lowest imperfections the flowers of purity bloom on the high summits of all things, principalities, and principles. Were this progressive redemptiveness not true, it would then be true to say, as do the orthodox, who see only absolute and irreconcilable opposites in the structure and method of the divine government, that, inasmuch as eternal value is stamped upon the soul with pure motives, so is there eternal condemnation written upon the soul that is moved with immoral motives. In all statements, you perceive, there are some items of truth. The material point of the present discourse is now reached, viz., the influence which immoral motives and impure purposes exert upon man's interior, upon the centers of his life, character, endowments, and faculties of his inmost, deathless spirit. High purposes invariably expand and exalt the best powers of the immortal mind, giving harmonial roundness, symmetrical beauty, and celestial completeness of inward growth. Pure motives go before the individual like a divine magnet, drawing the impressible spirit pleasurably onward, over all surrounding evils and prevailing embarrassments. There can be no defeat in that spirit which is actuated every day and in all moments by the largest, highest, purest purposes of which it can conceive. It has been clearly shown that the rich and powerful Jews, who persecuted and finally killed the body of the poor divine friend of humanity, supposing themselves successful the while, were really and totally defeated, bankrupt and overthrown in every exalted sense, but the man, who passed so completely through the terrific ordeal, was victorious every instant of time, outriding the temptations of passion, quelling the storms of the ages, and stilling the tempest of cupidity and selfishness. The Jews, successful in worldly matters, were in all other respects utterly defeated. Behold the effect of that martyrdom upon the world. It is teeming with beautiful sentiments of love and charity, with glorious civil and educational institutions, that have cropped out and blossomed from the fertile influence of that one example of a good man dying that his truths might live. High purposes alone presided. If the Infinite Father was so moved from the interior, this is the orthodox proposition, as to prepare and send to earth his only begotten, then the Father was actuated by the highest, deepest, and most heavenly purpose. He intended good to all and harm to none. Orthodoxy makes a sad theory of it. But the spiritual thought, within the crude doctrine, is not destitute of truth. The theory of the flowering out and incarnation of the divine spirit in a human being, exhibits love infinitely higher than force, and broader than intellect, and more influential, subduing enmities, overcoming evils, and banishing from the earth, passion and strife and war. This is the spiritual picture within the theoretical incarnation. In this light, the incarnation has been a success. Practically and philosophically, he alone is truly successful who is capable of embosoming and exemplifying those high motives which Mary's son felt, inculcated, and manifested in the far distant past. The infallible history of each person is written in the Summerland. A man who lives for himself, loses himself. If he wishes to gain the world, he as certainly loses it.